Here is my confession to you this week. I like to look at Bay Area real estate listings. I know I'm not the only one, and I think of it generally as entertainment and as a curiosity, but I have to wonder if there's not an element of penance to it also. It's a funny thing, right? Scrolling through the listings on Zillow or strolling by and stopping in front of one of those big windows full of beautiful homes up in the hills and really cute updated Berkeley bungalows, and usually my response is to laugh and maybe to sigh a little. And of course, there is nothing inherently wrong with real estate, but there's a twinge that hooks me. It has to do with wondering about worth, about measuring up. It gets me questioning, worrying about things like if it's good enough that my kids don't have a backyard where they can build a treehouse, or if it's good enough that we can't really host overnight guests comfortably. To a certain extent, it's a classic case of keeping up with the Joneses. But at its core, I think there's something deeper. It has to do with this fear about if God is really here. If God is here now, or if maybe God isn't here yet, that God won't be here until that bigger, shinier house, or maybe for you it's that right job or that perfect partner or fill in the blank. For those of you who don't know, I live next door. I live in one of the apartments upstairs in the parish house, and it's phenomenal, right? So, for starters, the commute cannot be beat, which is really saying something here in the Bay. And, you know, if I do run into traffic on my way to work, it's in the form of delightful neighbors or small children completely covered in sidewalk chalk. It is good. And we have collectively agreed that this building is so far gone that it is beyond any hope of restoration. And as soon as we have those permits in hand and funding secured, the building will be leveled. And this also is good. And it makes for an odd situation to call home. If I am really honest, sometimes when I look at those real estate listings, it makes me want to be less generous. It makes me wonder if maybe if we gave less money away, if we might be able to get a place that was bigger, shinier. It makes me think about whether if we gave up pledging, if we might be able to take on a mortgage, a place that maybe people could just look at and see that it was good without any of the explanation or the backstory. But it's not just about keeping up. Deeper than that, I think it's about this desire, this reaching for something concrete, something that can stand in, that we can hold on to and know that this is good now, that God is present here. And when we catch up with the people of Israel this morning, they are struggling with the same need, the same fear, right? They have been wandering. They have been out without any place they can really call home for some time. They fight, they squirm with this sense of scarcity, this question of if they have enough. They receive food, it sustains them, but nothing that they can hold on to. And now Moses is gone. Moses has gone up the mountain or to who knows where, and it's been a while since they saw him. And they start to wonder if he's coming back or if maybe he has abandoned them. And if he's abandoned them, if maybe God abandoned them also, if God was there to begin with. And so they take matters into their own hands. Right? Racked with fear and frustration, they gather what they can find of value, and they start to build, to pour, to mold, to create something concrete, something that can stand in for God, something that they can touch and verify and know. But at its core, it's something that can replace God, that they can revere in place of God, which is what the golden calf is. It's what our idols are, really. This idol business, it runs straight through the parable that Jesus offers us this morning also, right? We've got a king, and he is ready to throw the party to end all parties. His son is getting married, and we're going to pull out all the stops here. And so he makes ready the feast, and he sends out the invitations, and as soon as they go out, the excuses start rolling on back. Everybody's got something else that is more important. Somebody's got to go to work. Somebody's got, an obligation already. Somebody has something that they need to invest in more than this party. And this is where it gets nasty, right? These priorities, they get out of whack, and the idols start to clash with the invitation. But even past the violence, the king is determined to fill this hall. The party is going to happen. And so again, he sends out more invitations, sends his people out to find anyone and everyone and bring them in. Out in the streets, the sticks, come. And they do. They do, and finally the banquet hall is filled, the feast is happening, the party is underway, and it's good until the king comes in and sees this one poor sap who, he almost got there, he got halfway there, he showed up, but he's wearing the wrong clothes. And so this king takes him and casts him out into the outer darkness where there is weeping and gnashing of teeth, the whole nine yards. I find this ridiculous. Right? So the king, he's gone out and invited everyone to come in last minute. Come as you are. It's going to be a great feast. Oh, but you're not wearing the right clothes. It seems unfair. It seems like it's incongruous with the invitation that was just issued. And it seems, frankly, like a total overreaction. And I've wrestled with this. I've sat with this unfortunate twist in the parable all week and dug into it. And finally, stumbled across this piece in the Christian Century, where the author explained that it was typical in this day and age that the host would give out these garments to each guest as they arrived. They would come to the house, to the hall, and receive their garment, and they would put it on over their clothes. And so the king's rage then is not about what this man showed up wearing, how he arrived, what he brought with him. The king is angry because this person did not really respond to the invitation. He didn't enter fully into the celebration. We can't know what it was that held him back. We can't know what idol it is that has taken a hold of this man's affection and inverted his priorities. But I think that's what is at play here. For him and for us. It's a question of this competition between our idols and these invitations. So what is it for you? What undermines your values? What traps you, making it so hard to fully respond to the invitation that is at hand? For me, the answer slapped me upside the head this week. But to be honest, it was actually a small foot swinging by that nearly took out my face. Because a couple of weeks ago, my husband Jesse and I, we built monkey bars into the ceiling of our children's bedroom. In this building, this one. Right here, this building that is an eyesore. This building that has cost this church a great deal of angst in trying to maintain. This building that may be toxic enough that our neighbors are really concerned about what will happen when it is razed. And yet, it is full of life. What is for me an idol, the Bay Area real estate, this idol has made it hard for me to see that. This idol threatens to splinter my integrity. It undermines my values. It taunts me, asking me to invert my priorities and trade a practice of generosity for the fearful hope of a nicer home, whatever that means. And then it smacks me upside the head, this joy, this life, this sort of this perpetual motion machine now in this bedroom with laughter and glee from sun up to well past bedtime. And it's totally reoriented my sense of the place. It has reminded me that no, actually, this home, this life is good now. That God is present here. Not when, not if we get a bigger house or when we have a backyard. God is here. This is the power of naming our idols, friends. What is it for you? What is it that calls you away from who you are, from how you want to live? Maybe it's not a home. Maybe it's a job. Maybe it's degrees. Maybe it's... What is it for you? What is it that sows fear in your heart, that makes you wonder if maybe you don't have enough... That maybe you aren't enough. What is it that makes you tempted to trade what you care most about for something that promises much but leaves you empty. These are our idols. These are the ways that we try to take what is not God and put it in the place of God. I think that when we start to see them for what they are, when we start to name them for what they are, it becomes easier to see that God is right here. Whether we are wandering in the desert, whether we are feeling so overwhelmed by work that the idea of an invitation to a party is ridiculous, God is present. Because this is our truth, right? This is the truth that brings us together. This is why we gather. We gather because God is present among us now. Right now. And that God has always been present right here. So then, how will you set down your idols and hear this invitation and respond?